welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Joyce Morgenroth. Morgenroth is a professor of dance at Cornell University. She began her dance training at the School of American Ballet before majoring in theoretical mathematics at Cornell University. She also received a degree in French literature at Johns Hopkins. She has authored two books on the subject of dance. The 1987 title Dance Improvisations is still considered the definitive book on this subject. Her most recent book, published by Routledge Press in 2004, is called Speaking of Dance, 12 Contemporary Choreographers on Their Craft. Welcome to the show, Joyce.
Thank you.
Now, how did you develop an interest in dance?
It has to do with Nancy Laptook, someone who lived in my neighborhood, was dying to dance. I hadn't given it a thought one way or the other, at least not to ballet. I actually grew up in a family where there was a lot of social dancing that would happen in the living room in the evening, whatever. Mm-hmm. When Nancy and her mother found out that the School of American Ballet was auditioning girls, she was very excited. She was going to go. My mother heard about it. My mother had wished she had had ballet classes as a girl. Mm. So we went down also. I got in because I had good legs and feet, and Nancy didn't.
Oh,
she was heartbroken. She eventually did go. But it was one of those things where I didn't think about it in advance. It just happened, and I loved it immediately.
Uh-huh. And did you early on think that ballet and classical dance would be your forte?
I started at age 8, so I wasn't thinking one way or the other about what it would be. I came from a family where this was to be considered entertainment, you know, or something on the side, not what I would do seriously.
Yeah, I hope you get a serious job if you want to dance, right? Did you think classical training is important for most dancers, though?
It's very useful. We see a lot of students who come to Cornell who've only had classical dance, and they're reluctant to try anything else. They love it. They feel like that's what they want to do. But almost to a person, once they start something else, which is for us usually modern, because that's what we do primarily, they see that actually, for one thing, there are a lot of similarities. And also, in its own way, it's wonderful and demanding and exciting and beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So they get more versatile.
Yeah, it's a real sport. I mean, people don't think of it that way. You have to be in really good...
I love to see men come to the classes because they think, oh, girl stuff, and then they come and they can't do it. It's hard.
It looks hard to me.
So,
Now, when did you segue from being a dancer to taking up choreography?
Oh, well, it goes back and forth. Mm. So basically, when I entered high school, I actually gave up on dance because I went to the Bronx High School of Science. That was a commute. The ballet school was a commute. So I just couldn't do everything, not to mention 4 hours of homework every night.
Mm.
So I gave it up mournfully, regretfully. When I came to Cornell, they didn't have ballet. So I started doing modern, and that was one of my main extracurricular activities while I was doing my math. But at science, I was already tracked into this math-science route,
mm-hmm.
and I guess already math was my specialty somehow. And, you know, the interesting thing is when I go all the way back to sixth grade, they were saying, okay, do you want to be in journalism, or do you want to be in science? And I knew exactly what I wanted to do, journalism. And they put me in science.
Well, why were they giving
you
those two choices?
It was the Sputnik era. Oh. Well, I was in New York City. They had certain special classes for kids who were, you know, high achievers. And it was the Sputnik era, and they really actually, I don't know why they asked. They had already decided which kids were going to go into the science class. They thought, okay, these kids who really seem to, you know, have something on the ball, we're going to put them in the science class. I loved it. You know, I could do it. And actually, I think for my particular type of intelligence, math was a good match.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when I was in college, it became clear that I had many other loves, and the other courses I took while I was doing my math major, which was not a big major, it was a difficult and very focused major, but didn't have labs and it didn't have a lot of courses,
mm-hmm.
I took creative writing, I took drawing, I took music appreciation, I danced every afternoon. So clearly this other side of me was healthy and thriving also at Cornell.
Absolutely. We had to be in the arts somewhere, didn't you?
I guess so. You know, and it was quite unselfconscious. It's just what I wanted to do, and I was pursuing it. But by my senior year, I knew I didn't want to go on in math for various reasons. It was also Vietnam era. I just thought anything I do will somehow contribute to the war, even if it's teaching math to high school kids. I just wasn't comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to have a conversation with someone who said, well, what have you loved at Cornell? And I thought, well, my French literature classes. So this is second day of semester, my senior year, and I ended up changing everything, and I did a lot of French literature and language my last year, finished my math major, but meanwhile was applying to graduate school in French literature.
That is unbelievable.
So I went to Johns Hopkins, where they had been very daring to take someone who hadn't majored in French. But it was a very exciting time.
What made you interested in French literature? Was that out of the blue?
It was something I had also done. You know, you had to do a certain amount of language at Cornell. I'd had very good teachers. The courses were really fascinating to me. It was that simple. I just enjoyed those courses.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Now, you did get a degree in mathematics, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I keep thinking that there might be a connection between mathematics and dance. Am I wrong?
No,
Tell me about that. It fascinates me.
Yeah, I feel it might not be true for everyone, but for me, one of the things I love in dance is the structure. And I think for years I've seen all these mathematicians trudging across the campus to go hear music concerts. In music, the structure is absolutely audible. I think people recognize that more readily.
Mm-hmm.
But in choreography, there's also structure. And that varies. There is more formalist dance, and there's more narrative dance, and you know, there's not a line, dividing line between the two. But I think for someone with my particular take on the subject, the formalist aspects are the most attractive.
Mm-hmm. And so did you have to translate your mathematical mind into choreography? Let's talk a little bit more about how you got into becoming a choreographer.
It was an option. Let's see, I think in my last year or two as an undergraduate at Cornell, there was dance club, and I was in dance club, and we could choreograph. And at that point, I didn't know exactly what I was doing, but I put some things together, and I really liked it. The thing that actually got me back into dance was after 3 years at Johns Hopkins, I was working on my dissertation. Baltimore at that time was really a sort of washout. There was nothing there.
Mm.
Nothing. It's nothing like what it is now. It's
mm-hmm.
become quite an interesting city.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't particularly interested in staying there, and some of my friends were also moving on. And I knew the dance teacher at Cornell, Peggy Lawler, because she had come while I was a senior, so I'd gotten to know her. And she said they needed a part-time person, and did I want to come? So instead of continuing my fellowship at Hopkins, I thought, well, I'll just go to Cornell. I'll use their library. I know some of the students there and some of the professors. It'll be fine. In fact, I was teaching several dance classes to make my pittance. I can't tell you how little it was.
Oh, I believe it.
And the whole social, interpersonal, lively part of my life was in dance. The lonely part of my life now was doing my dissertation. And more and more I wanted to dance, and less I wanted to sort of do this very isolated activity.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel a need to create your own dances, too? Was that the creative side of you that you didn't want to have to follow someone else's?
I liked both. I mean, at that point in my life, I loved being in other people's work, but I was at Cornell for 3 years, sort of working less and less on the dissertation and doing more and more of the dance. And by the end of those 3 years, choreography really had become the thing that I loved. And it engaged my imagination in a way that was very thorough.
And the mathematician in you, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about that book that you wrote, Dance Improvisations, in the late 80s. A lot of people think of improvisation as something that's just spontaneous.
Right.
But improvisation in dance really is planned out, choreographed.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about this.
One can just get up and improvise, I basically think of the approach that I give there as something, you might call it structured improvisation. And I feel like the more that you focus on some aspect of, let's say, dance, and in a sense it's dance composition, the more liberated your creativity will be. You know, imagine going into a room, oh, I could do anything. Well, anything's awfully close to what?
Yeah,
nothing. Who knows? It's like being in a sea, you know, you're just bobbing around. Whereas if you say, I'm going to do something that gradually progresses across the space, goes from the highest point to the lowest point, and has, you know, five events along the way, well, you just start doing it. You know what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm particularly interested in that, in this approach and in the work that I did for that book in group improvisations. So I really try to have the dancers or students learn to be attentive to what's going on in the space so that they can develop a relevant response. So it's really, in a way, it's hardly about creativity. It's not about what can I do now or what will be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about what's relevant. And that has something to do with there being limitations. You know, there being some sense of this particular improvisation has certain characteristics. So the way in which the book works, it's almost like a cookbook. Chapters on levels or floor patterns or groupings or rhythm. And in each one, you also can progress from something that's quite prescriptive, so you get focused on that, and then it can get freer and freer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
But you talk about how you need a leader.
Yeah. The leader functions, in a sense, you know, if you were with a group and there were not one designated leader, but they wanted to work with this sort of cookbook, one of them could say, okay, we'll do this, and just sort of read off the instructions, in a sense, and mm-hmm. that would be fine. It's nice having someone sit out in the sense that they can give you feedback, even in the sense of asking questions to elicit feedback,
mm-hmm.
because fairly often from within it, you know what worked and what maybe didn't really gel.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had the experience where you worked on a dance that you had choreographed, and once the performance happened, it totally didn't work?
I find out before the performance.
Really?
Oh, sure.
Because
I mean,
I was thinking maybe the players even could change or not measure up or.
Well, the thing about dance is, and this is relates to what I was saying earlier about how social it is, which is a plus and a minus at times.
Mm-hmm.
At times you feel like, can we find a time when we can all get together to rehearse?
It's like theater.
Yeah,
exactly.
It is.
Yep.
So you're working with the dancers the whole time. You don't choreograph it in your head and then, or even in your own body, and then throw it on the dancers the last week.
Mm.
So basically, you maybe spend 4 hours in the studio, and if you're lucky, come up with a minute or two of material, depending upon whether it's, you know, for one person or a group, and then you rehearse with them. Then you revise that as you go on. So each time you come back, you're also looking and constantly revising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also, whenever possible, have someone else come in and look at some point when the piece has some shape, or if I feel like it's not taking shape, then I will bring one of my colleagues in and you just have them give me some feedback.
Mm-hmm. So you generally don't have any surprises on performance night?
No.
Yeah,
no.
I was wondering about that. Now, you taught a course that explored the parallels between scientific research and art making.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? It's sort of an expansion on the mathematics.
It is. It's, you know, it's very exciting to me. I feel like I've come around to this after years of, quite frankly, I don't remember anything about my math training. It was so highly theoretical and you know, really, one doesn't have to deal with functions of a single variable in one's normal life.
Are you kidding, Joyce? I deal with that every day.
Wow. I'll let you do my checkbook.
It even is.
That's right. Well, that's why I said that, because that was one of the courses I took. And, you know, my father, who was actually quite upset that I'd gone from math to French, was just mortified when I went from French to dance, you know. But he'd say, well, what are you doing with your math? I said, I guess I'm balancing my checkbook. But now, you know, whatever, 30, 40 years later, I feel like I've gotten to indulge that old interest. More physics than math, but I, at some point when I was interviewing Merce Cunningham for the second book, he said, well, you know, when I heard that Einstein had said that there are no fixed points in space, I realized it could all be different. And he started what essentially was a revolution that's ongoing to this very day for the last 50, 60 years in modern / postmodern dance. And I started to think this seemed an awful lot that I just saw parallels between what was going on in choreography and what was going on in this extremely abstruse and unintuitive contemporary physics, starting with relativity, quantum theory, and going on to string theory and the other things that are happening now. And I just had a sense that there were some connections. So I started to read a bunch of these really fascinating physics books that are out now that are meant for the layman who has some sort of education and the patience to really slog through and pay attention and go as slowly as you have to. So Brian Greene's Elegant Universe or books by Mario Livio, which are more on mathematics, et cetera, et cetera. There are chaos theory.
Oh, yeah.
There are some really excellent, fascinating books. And in each of them, I saw some parallel, as well as seeing parallels usually with particular choreographers. And in fact, there are certain choreographers who intentionally have worked in ways that they consider mathematical or addressing what's going on in physics. Now, sometimes they're actually making the connection in a sort of metaphorical way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's part of what's been fun for me, is to sort of parse this, you know, somehow to find the strands that are really almost scientific in what the choreographers are doing. Mm-hmm. And what's somewhat more a metaphorical take on what's happening in physics now, the way a layman might be able to look and just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joyce Morgenroth. She's a professor of dance at Cornell University. And you mentioned Merce Cunningham. I want to ask you about Isadora Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote an article about her.
Yeah.
Is she still an influence in today's dance?
Oh, no, not really.
Really?
I would say she was someone who whose main import was in breaking away from ballet.
Yes.
She and someone who was even earlier, another American in France, Loie Fuller, who basically said the body can move in a freer way, doesn't have to be restricted by toe shoes, doesn't have to be restricted by corsets and tutus, doesn't have to work within the rigors of the sort of corps de ballet and the soloists.
Mm-hmm.
But Isadora Duncan herself was a free spirit. And in some way, what she did was very much expressing herself. And people still tend to think of modern dance as expressive dance.
They do.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that pretty much ran its course in the beginning of the 20th century. So 100 years ago, or less, maybe 80 years ago.
I wonder why people still think of Isadora Duncan as the beginning of modern dance.
Well, it was the beginning.
Yeah.
It was the beginning, but it's really moved on
but
since
then. But
it
has then. Moved on.
It has. I mean, for one thing, the phase it's in now, I think, is much more intellectual, mm-hmm. much more political.
Much more disciplined as well, I would
physically
think.
Disciplined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's too bad that people's delusions are continuing forward.
Well, you know, there was that period when her autobiography came out, and suddenly it put modern dance on the map temporarily. I think it's maybe the 70s. Or
you're talking about the film with
well,
with
and the film,
Rave too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That really did put dance on the map.
For a while.
Yeah.
You know, but and I mean, whenever a film comes out, then or if TV hasn't exactly discovered this kind of dance, concert dance.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think has the most influence in today's dance world?
I think for at least one entire branch, Merce Cunningham, mm-hmm. who is
still
88?
Yes.
Or 89, maybe, is still absolutely, unbelievably inventive, has a complete control about what it is he's after. He's passionate about it. He's a very modest, gentle person at the same time. He's an extraordinary presence in the dance world. And other people have done very, very innovative things. But I think those who have probably would still say, I couldn't have done it if Merce Cunningham and John Cage hadn't made the breakthroughs that they made.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual work that Merce Cunningham is still making is still stunningly interesting, beautiful.
Modern, probably, still?
Yeah.
To most people?
Yeah.
That is remarkable. You don't think of dance careers going into the 80s,
no.
Do you?
Well, he's been incredibly inventive at adapting as he needed to. So now he works with a computer program called Dance Forms.
Mm.
He's pretty much confined to a wheelchair. So he can't do, but he can create it on the screen. It's laborious for the dancers, but they're learning a lot of their material off a computer screen now.
Uh-huh. You know what? That brings me to a question that I had for you. How has this high-tech world of computers and global communications changed dance?
It's in the process. You know, I don't know yet exactly what will happen. I mean, one great thing was video. I mean, one can actually create a document of one's dance, because before that, any sort of writing, you know, written form, laba notation, or some sort of written notation for dance was too cumbersome to use. You had to be trained for years to learn any sort of notation. It's not like music notation you can learn in a half hour, really. You know, it's just horrible. So you can imagine, it's not like a note. It's a whole body with 10 fingers and, you know, a face that,
imagine.
To capture. It's impossible.
Uh-huh.
So, and film was prohibitively expensive. So that's a simple thing. Video has allowed people to both work with it as a tool, just tape their improvisations, use that as something they can look at and say, I like that, I'm going to teach that part to
my dancers. So it's going to be used as a rehearsal tool.
And a rehearsal tool.
Or just a building.
I like to videotape my rehearsals, look at it afterwards and say, I like this, I don't like this, I'm going to change this, and save my dancers the time of my saying, can I see that again? I don't have to. I don't have to bother them with that. I can do it with the videotape just as well.
And do students in dance actually use the videotape to turn in what we used to call paper?
No.
No?
No.
They still have to do live
That's
performance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, occasionally, there is much newer technology than this. There's stuff that's newer than 40 years ago. There's an interest today in interactive technology, and some people are playing around with ways in which, for example, the movement of bodies in a certain area of the space might set off cues for sound or for certain types of projection, so that in performance you're getting a simultaneous response from the computer to create some other either visual or audio aspect of the performance.
Mm-hmm.
I have yet to be extremely impressed by what the product is. You know, to me it's not necessarily better than something that had been decided on in advance, either musically or in the way of, you know, maybe projections.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still in its infancy, still to be seen what's possible. And people are creating virtual dance via using, like, Life Forms program in order to just put sensors on the different joints, videotape people moving, and now you suddenly have this body that's a sort of disembodied body that can do a dance.
That's interesting.
And that might be used as a projection while they're alive people, or it could be something that exists on its own.
Mm.
So people are playing around with it. I feel like it's still in a very exploratory phase.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it. Yeah, it must be. Now, your most recent book, Speaking of Dance, 12 Contemporary Choreographers on Their Craft, tell us how you decided to write this. You just wanted to go interview incredible choreographers, or what?
That was probably in the back of my mind, but I think most specifically, I had a friend who's a musician and writer, Anne McCutcheon, who had written a book called The Muse That Sings, and she had interviewed contemporary composers.
Mm.
I read that book and I loved it. I was fascinated. I laughed. I mean, I loved the different voices coming through, and I learned a lot, and I just thought, this should be done for dance. And I loved the format she had used, which was instead of having the very straightforward but a little bit sort of cumbersome question and answer. She had edited things into a running narrative, and I liked that. So mm-hmm. I spoke to her. I said, are you comfortable with my just taking your format and running? She said, oh, great. She'd love to see it happen in dance. So I sort of used her model, and it worked beautifully. I had a wonderful time with that writing side, because I also love writing. Mm. But the whole point was to keep the choreographer's voice. But when you speak, of course, that's not necessarily exactly how you want things to be written. And the order in which you say things is maybe not perfect. So I was able to juggle things around and try to make an interesting sequence.
Tell us just a couple of the people that you interviewed. Merce, of course.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Trisha Brown and David Gordon, Anna Halperin, who's in San Francisco area, Mark Morris, who's a very well-known, popular. I mean, they ranged from people who are really prominent in the sort of smaller, serious dance world to people who are not even so prominent in the smaller, serious dance world, who are in some sense thought of as up-and-coming, to people who have really made a splash a little bit more, you know, like Mark Morris has just mm-hmm. figured out how to get many, many, many people interested in what he does. Mm-hmm. It's partly the way in which he works with music.
Did you find anything surprising about some of these interviews?
I was partly surprised by how wonderful and gracious they were. You know, I was, for most of them, a stranger approaching them, and half the time I would meet them in their kitchen, or, you know, or their dining room. They'd sit me down, and we'd sit at this table and talk, and maybe they'd have prepared some tea or a little luncheon or something, and they were just generous. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had actually paid attention not only to whether I loved their choreography and thought it was important, but to whether they could talk.
That's a good question.
So, yes. So all but one, I would say, really spoke articulately and beautifully. And one, I would say, how is it different working with ballet dancers versus working with modern dancers? And she would say, oh, totally different. I'd say, in what ways? She'd say, in every way. And finally, I would say, it will help me a lot if you give me some details. You know, that's going to be the text.
And she was unable to do so.
I pushed and pulled, and we got some. And then there was an ongoing conversation, in a way, via my sending her a version of the edited text, and she sent me back some additions, and mm-hmm. I was able to re-edit, so I got somewhat more. But she was the only one where I thought, there just won't be enough here. You know, whereas everyone else, even from the minute they started talking, I thought, even if they talked for only 15 minutes, it's fascinating already.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joyce, we only have about 1 minute left. And is there anything you're working on now? Any productions that we could look forward to?
Not productions right now. I'm at this moment still trying to get some writing out on this physics and mathematics and dance thing, and having a good time right now.
And then this is going to be for the layperson as well, right?
Or yes, it is. I'm hoping to get two arcane, inaccessible areas to be somewhat more accessible to people who like to read and like to think about things.
And physics and dance is your choice of trying to make things explicit. Right. Okay. Well, Joyce Morgenroth, thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman. Mm-hmm.